Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
What shall we call this program? Green with Envy, How Green is My Valley? I think we'll stay with Going Green. Hello, I'm Jerry Christensen. And this is the Seminary Explores with Mr. John Spangler, the Reverend John Spangler, who is the Executive Assistant to the President of Gettysburg Seminary for Communication and Planning, and the former President of the Seminary Ridge Historic Preservation Foundation, and the leading light in the plan of this 53-acre plot on Seminary Ridge to go green. What got you started on this process of trying to make a whole seminary, an old seminary, green?
Well, thank you, Jerry. It's great to talk about this topic, which is really important to me personally. I would say that what got us started here is the fact that we're probably a medium-sized seminary with a large-sized campus for a theological graduate and professional school. So we really had to begin to think in recent years, in the last decade and a half, about what could make 25 buildings on 52 or so acres sustainable and usable for the long run. How do we make a campus like ours more efficient? And what it began to become clear to me was that there were two big interests that were converging here: the need to be efficient and the need to be sustainable. And maybe a third component, the need to be prudent in how we spend money in the context of a graduate school. We're beginning to converge, and the interests of becoming more efficient and less costly in how we heat and cool and run our facilities started to look like a potential project, or at least a topic we needed to study carefully. And long about mid-decade 2005 or 6, I was given some responsibility to look at planning processes for the seminary, not only institutionally but also how we might plan to make good use of our facilities and our resource deployment around that. And I would say that in the past we had been very good stewards of everything that we had here. We would run something right to the end of its cycle of life, and we would tend to replace technologies, facilities, with the best that we could possibly do at that moment, and quite often replacing the same kind of technology. For example, the seminary was forward-thinking back in the late 19th century when it implemented a central steam heat process, piping steam across the campus from one central boiler place. And that was an efficiency. That was a way of distributing that kind of energy and doing it in a central way and making it simpler. And we were just kind of replacing that. And when pipes failed, we would dig them up and put them back together again. But that really, you know, that needed to change probably about 10, 15 years ago, when we needed to start asking the question. We've been holding it together on what has worked very well for the last 100 years, but we need to start thinking about what is the appropriate thing for us to be doing for the next 100 years. And that's why we needed to start looking around at some of the newer technologies that were coming along the pike, new ways of utilizing energy more efficiently. And so we were asking those questions, and I had support of the seminary president and even the board to move forward in engaging in feasibility studies for certain kinds of possibilities. We had land here. Mm-hmm. We actually had land that had rock underneath it here on a ridge. And that's the kind of geography that is appropriate for geothermal technology. Mm-hmm. And in the research that we did, I asked around in one of our sister seminaries, Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa, had implemented a geothermal heating and cooling system for its campus, for at least a part of its campus. And I learned from them that the payback period for this kind of technology had dropped to under 10 years. By way of payback, I mean the difference between the cost of a conventional system and something that involves more upfront costs like a geothermal system. Mm-hmm. The payback difference there between those two kinds of systems were dropping with greater efficiencies in heat pumps and air conditioning units, that kind of thing, and cost of energy itself, yeah. The oil and the gas that was on the rise at that mm-hmm. in that particular cycle, and when it fell below 10 years in some places, I thought we better take a look at that yeah. because we've been here for about 180 years yeah. at the time, and we think we're going to be here for another long stretch yet. So it would be foolish not to be looking at these kinds of things.
Let me just interrupt to ask, what is geothermal? I happen to have seen what it was, so I could describe it myself, but it was fun to watch because it's something of a crapshoot too, is it not? But first of all, I better explain what geothermal is.
Yes, geothermal technology for heating and cooling is a technology that takes advantage of the relatively stable temperature of the Earth underneath our ground here. That temperature tends to be somewhere in the range of 50 to 55 degrees, and depends on where you are and what the climate is, actually. But that temperature stays pretty much the same year-round. And what you can do, what that enables you to do, if you run geothermal wells, piping of mm-hmm. water mm-hmm. down into that ground, and if you have a lot of heat that you need to dissipate from inside the building, such as you do in the summer, then you put that use a heat pump to take the heat out mm-hmm. of the air and put it into the fluid, mm-hmm. into the water, and you pump that through the earth, and it basically cools that down mm-hmm. to that temperature point where the Earth is, say 50 degrees, just for the sake of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
From there, you do the opposite is what occurs then in the wintertime when you have cold temperatures. You take that cold and you place it inside the fluid and you run that fluid through the Earth, and you have very cold temperatures that you basically bring up. Mm-hmm. To warm them up 50, to that mm-hmm. 50 degrees mm-hmm. or so.
So you only have to heat above 50 degrees rather than above 80 degrees. If it's that cold.
That's right. You apply usually electricity in the heat mm-hmm. pump technology, like an air conditioner and like an electric heat mm-hmm. Device. And actually, the air conditioner is the best analogy for this because it throws cold out on one side and it throws heat out on the other mm-hmm. outside mm-hmm. in the way normally air conditioners are set up. But in the wintertime, if you reverse that process, mm-hmm. you would notice that you could throw heat to the inside and throw your cold out into the cold.
Then there was a large plan put in place then for, once you got started, for becoming the greenest possible campus that we could achieve?
Yeah, the sequence here is that we had a serious feasibility study by engineers who mm-hmm. took a look at our central set of buildings and gave us an analysis of what it would take to retrofit these buildings with this new technology, and what the cost would be, what the relative payback periods would be, depending upon the cost of fuel and money and other things, other factors. And it became part of our master plan to go forward, because we actually did drill a well, a test well, to see what we actually had under the ground and to make sure that we had the kind of geology below the surface that would support this whole idea. And we found we were getting good grades on all marks. And so we had a kind of institutional plan that we felt was a wise way forward and good for us. However, and we were thinking that the next thing we might do is start to implement that plan one building at a time. But the Great Recession of 2008 made it really shaky for institutions that have endowments and have tuition and other kinds of costs. So a lot of those plans went on hold. Yet in the meantime, a couple of other things happened. Our recycling here on campus was pretty minimal. I think that we threw away about 80% of our waste into the trash, and we were recycling probably about 20% of our paper and plastic goods. And we decided to create a green task force that would involve students and faculty and staff members, spouses and families of students who lived on campus, and talk a little bit about what we thought we might do. And what we learned was that we were going to need to really educate the campus and to really raise awareness amongst those who lived and worked and studied here, and that we really could probably make a huge difference in just what we were recycling. And I think that over a period of a couple of years, we moved that ratio closer to 60% and 40% of 40% being recycled material. Mm-hmm. And I think we may be even closer to the 50% mark now, maybe moving it the other way. In certain buildings, I am sure. In fact, our main building, Valentine, I'm pretty sure that we're recycling a lot more than we're throwing away.
Our guest is the Reverend John Spangler, who is the Executive Assistant to the President for Communications and Planning. And we're talking about going green on a 53-acre campus, a relatively small campus for a big institution, but still in some ways a very big campus for a small institution, and how we can make that the greenest possible, and what maybe those of you who are listening to this podcast might learn from the experience here. I'm Jerry Christensen. I wonder about a couple of things that that you've incorporated into that plan. Most remarkably, if I may say so as an outsider, John, you have had more impact on the campus design, the footprint on the campus, than probably any other person since Simon Schmucker, if you don't mind my saying, in that you've instituted a historic walking pathway with the cooperation of other people, of course. And it did not come without a lot of challenge and a lot of difficulty. What was the rationale behind that historic walking pathway? Was it related to going green?
Well, it was in some ways. I think the original intent was for various institutional partners in and around Gettysburg were really being asked to consider how can we develop a much more enticing walking experience for what is inside the green belt of the Gettysburg National Military Park, a borough that's intact and has boundaries and has that urban feel of neighborhoods and walkable scale. How do we help people enjoy that walking experience in the Gettysburg borough in particular, and introduce people to that living history that is in and around the town that may not be highlighted by the National Park Service in all cases? Seminary was a prime example of a place that had a lot of history, not only battle history and theological education, but literary history, with L.C. Singh Master Lewers living here, with other kinds of stories to tell, like the first African-American who was educated in the seminary context, which is a very early integration story for any graduate study in anywhere in the country. Daniel Payne's story was one that we could tell along a wayside, along a looping trail, a pathway through the campus. And so called for by an interpretive plan for the town from the 1990s, the seminary applied for a grant from transportation funds through PennDOT the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, and successfully got a grant that enabled us to plan it and to implement part of it. Later on, we were fortunate to be able to get a supplementary grant, a bigger one, that helped us complete the pathway that, as it stands now, is a 1.04-mile looping pathway through the campus with about 18 historic waysides that help tell some of these stories that that come out of Seminary Ridge.
That's related to a new museum, which we may or may not get to talk about today. There's plenty of time in the future to talk. But one thing that does strike me as being part of the Going Green goal of your plan is that it involved expanding the parking lot. I mean, that's the sort of thing we probably in some ways don't want to encourage because it means more, you know, more gas emissions and so on. But still, this is a, an institution that wants to make a greater impact on the community and allow the use of this campus for such things as music and the arts and lectures. So a new parking lot was called for, but at the same time, how to make that green. That was your challenge.
There really was integration between the creation of the pathway and a safer, more rational scheme for parking on the campus. And it had to do with the way you manage stormwater. Everyone who builds anything nowadays knows that there are requirements to manage stormwater, and when it falls on the on our buildings and in our parking lots, and it drains away into sewer lines, and needs to be treated before it can be restored for possible use later on. Now, the idea that engineers, real and boroughs require of us is to try to keep that water on the site and recharging the water tables right where it falls. So with, imagine if we were able to keep all of the rain that falls on the 52 acres going straight down into the water table using the natural filtering process. What happens is we were asked to create rain gardens or rain basins that would allow that water to be heading downward and not running off into the sidewalk streets and in and making putting pressure on the borough's storm sewer system. So we've done that, and by creating several acres of these rain gardens and a pathway that was 10 feet wide and moving through the campus, we discovered that we removed about 5 acres from what we had to mow. And mowing you wouldn't necessarily think of as a intensive carbon producing event, but actually it's a very intensive carbon process. In one of our classes taught by Gil Waldkenig, worth talking about what we're teaching these days, but in that class that was exploring environment, ecotheology even, there was a project that was undertaken by a group of students to measure the seminary's carbon footprint before we started to implement any of the geothermal well fields, any of the recycling measures, before we had rain gardens on campus. And we found they found out that we had 1,036 tons of carbon dioxide that we produced in the year 2010.
Wow.
what they discovered just shocked me on several fronts. One of those points was that the amount of gas, carbon that we throw into the atmosphere every year by virtue of mowing our lawns here at the seminary would be the equivalent of driving a car back and forth across the continent here 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
That's how much consumption is involved in just that mowing activity. So we're looking for ways of letting some areas grow more naturally and not maintaining all of our acreage as that beautiful suburban lawn, which we're learning about just how expensive it is, how much those lawns actually consume in energy and in time and labor and chemicals to keep them looking nice.
You haven't considered going back to the Schmucker days and having a herd of goats perhaps wander the campus or cattle to keep it down?
I won't say it hasn't come up in conversation.
Maybe it has.
We haven't considered it yet.
Last but not least, you already touched on this, John, the relationship between teaching and practice. We'll talk to Gilwell Koenig in the future about the actual class in this, but part of the plan was to engage students in the process of thinking about and planning for going green wherever they land in their professions.
Yes, you can. I mean, the example that I just cited was one of the ways in which our institutional planning efforts to go green provide a kind of laboratory for our students who are learning about ecology in the classroom, but also they're also learning how to steward older structures. Many of our congregations and church-related agencies have built environments that are decades, maybe even centuries old, and we have buildings that run to about 189 years of age here, and that's a perfect example that as we struggle with this, we remain transparent, open to how we're doing this, how we're trying to be faithful stewards and good stewards of these buildings, the general environment, so that they can see how they might apply some of this thinking in their congregations, in their agencies, wherever they're going to serve in the world. They're going to encounter some kind of desire and need to be more efficient, to be more environmentally responsible, to be thinking ahead rather than just replacing what is in place, asking the question that we're trying to do whenever an opportunity and a decision has to be made on how we maintain or rebuild or build buildings. An example here is the museum rehabilitation project, which was a building built in 1832, but one that we were having to apply for historic tax credits and was going to be a museum. But maintaining our commitment to be green, we were seeking LEED certification, which is Leadership in Environmental Design. And that kind of certification, which in the end we were able to receive LEED certification, mm-hmm. Provided another example of learning about that process, kind of understanding how the building organizations work, what they expect, what it takes, and the costs of actually maintaining record keeping and doing the kind of recycling and tracking of material.
So we can talk about recycling, about deep water wells, about new technologies for heating and cooling. We can talk about tree planting, and we can talk about LEED certification, all of which other groups and organizations, including churches, can do, and then use this as the opportunity for teaching as well as practice. Our guest, John Spangler, Executive Assistant to the President for Communication and Planning, and former President of the Seminary Ridge Historic Preservation Foundation. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers from Historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.